Welcome to Short Science, your international era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke.
And I'm Katie Draper. Today, we're actually going to be looking at the internet code, so we'll be thinking about just what the internet's made of and how this is changing. We'll also be taking a look at HTML, Flash, as well as the upcoming HTML5.
That's right, and we'll be trying to keep this all nice and simple because it's rather a mind-bending topic. This is Short Science. So hello and welcome to the show. Now today we are broadcasting from the Common Room at Imperial College on a rather grey afternoon. And with me I have Katie Draper, who I'm sure you'll all remember from such great episodes as number 76 on commercial space travel and episode 87 a few weeks ago on language. So welcome back, Katie.
Thanks. It's great to be back on Short Science, although I'm a little bit more nervous about this topic. It's a little bit more tricky than some of the other ones I've looked at, but hopefully we'll find our way through it.
It is indeed tricky. And we're going to be tackling it and trying to keep it as simple as possible. And we're going to be looking at just what the internet is made of. So we'll be looking at internet code from two different perspectives, the technical and the sociological. The code that makes the internet into the physical reality we see, and the code that determines how we interact with the cyber world.
Yeah, that's right, Elizabeth. So we'll be looking at HTML and the complexities of how the internet is technically constructed, and I'll be looking at the social codes that have arisen as the popularity of the internet has reached astronomic proportions.
But before we get going with today's show, let's take a look ahead to next week. So if you were listening last week, you'll know that next week we'll be welcoming a very special surprise guest presenter to the show, which will be all about inheritance.
So we'd like to know what you think about inheritance, the old nature versus nurture debate. How can we attribute to our genes, and how much of our physical and psychological being is moulded by our environment and experience?
Absolutely. So we'd really like to know what you think. So you can call in and have your thoughts broadcast live on air. Now you can call any time between now and next Tuesday, and the number you need to dial is 07401 856-681, and that will put you straight through to our recording service, where you'll then have 2 minutes to set the world straight on whatever you fancy. And then we'll play your recording out live on air. And it doesn't matter if it goes wrong when you ring up, just hang up and redial, and we promise to delete your bloopers right off the system. Or if you're more of an email person, you can send any material you like to studio@shortscience.co.uk.
We can't wait to hear what you guys think, so pick up the phone and get in touch.
Okay, it's time to get back to today's show now. So it's time for the Short Science News in Brief.
Radar could be used to track flying animals. The technology, typically used for tracking storms, could transform the study of birds, bats and other flying insects. It's thought that with further technical enhancements, a resolution could be achieved that would allow for a single bee to be detected at 50 kilometres away. The new field is being referred to as aeroecology. So the concept of aeroecology is to answer questions about how organisms move and use the aerosphere. So it's hoped that by examining animal flight patterns as well as behaviours, scientists can monitor how they're affected by man and the environment, which could be crucial in conservation efforts.
Cholesterol cannot predict female strokes. Researchers in Denmark have found that measuring cholesterol levels is not a good way to predict the risk of stroke in women. Their report in the Annals of Neurology instead recommends that measuring a different type of fat in the blood is more accurate, and they're suggesting that something called non-fasting triglyceride levels are used instead. Now, this is a blood test that can be taken at any time and doesn't matter what you've been eating beforehand, unlike with the current tests where you have to fast. The Stroke Association is advocating that this test becomes routine in order to try to prevent some of the 150,000 strokes that occur in the UK each year.
A key breast cancer gene has been found. The oncogene ZNF703 is the first to be discovered in 5 years and is thought to cause a particularly aggressive form of breast cancer. This gene is overactive in around 1 in 12 breast cancers and could account for up to 4,000 UK cases each year. The scientists looked at gene activity in over 1,000 breast tumour samples, as well as looking at breast cancer cells grown in the lab. They were able to eliminate genes until there was only the ZNF703 gene left within a region of chromosome 8 that was overactive in all the samples tested. It is hoped that just as the discovery of HER2, another oncogene, led to the development of Herceptin, a drug designed specifically to target tumours in which ZNF703 is overactive, could also be developed.
Revolutionary blood pressure watch. A new blood pressure measuring device has been developed by researchers in Leicester and Singapore. Instead of compressing the arm arteries to get a measure of pressure like the traditional method, this monitor works by sensing the pressure wave inside the artery as the heart beats. Now, this gives an accurate measure of the pressure within the main artery of the body, the aorta. This is a radical departure from over a century of traditional blood pressure monitoring, and doctors expect that this new method will be commonplace in years to come.
Peruvian potatoes to be safeguarded in an ice vault. Farmers in Peru are sending 1,500 varieties of potatoes, the world's most important non-cereal crop, to a vault in the Arctic Circle in order to safeguard the species against natural as well as human disasters. The Andes are home to more than 4,000 native varieties, but these appear to be at risk. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which opened in February 2008, was designed to store duplicates of all seed samples from the world's crop collections. Permafrost and thick rocks surrounding the vault, built 130 metres inside a mountain, ensure that the samples will remain frozen even in the case of a power failure. The Global Crop Diversity Trust, which operates the facility, described it as the ultimate insurance policy for the world's food supply.
Researchers to cure forgetfulness. Modern, hectic lifestyles have led to a massive increase in subjective cognitive impairment, or forgetfulness, and researchers have launched a study to try to find a way to halt this trend. They're investigating whether using low doses of drugs used to treat conditions like Alzheimer's may in fact stop us from being forgetful.
Koalas make a racket to attract a mate. Contrary to the typical view of koalas as quiet marsupials, males can produce a deep, growling bellow to attract females. The study, conducted off the coast of Queensland, found that increased female movement coincided with male bellowing, suggesting that females are searching out these males. This could help to reduce the risk of inbreeding within groups. It is thought that a female can determine how attractive a potential mate is by the sound of his voice. For instance, larger males appear to be able to bellow for longer, and this could be an important information for females.
And finally today, pessimism opposite to placebo. Researchers have found that if a patient does not expect a medication to work, the chances are increased that it in fact won't work. They have demonstrated that the benefits of painkillers can be completely destroyed if the patient believes that the drugs won't relieve their pain. Scientists use a drip to hide whether or not they were giving painkillers at any given time while a painful stimulus was being applied to the legs of the participants. They were then falsely told to expect pain relief or no pain relief. The results were correlated, and with the expectation of pain relief, more pain was relieved than with the covert administration of the painkiller. With the expectation of no pain relief, the pain was rated as more severe, even when the painkiller was covertly given, highlighting the important psychological aspects of drug efficacy and symptom relief. Well, that's it for our science news today. Now, if you've got any comments or questions about any of our stories, give us a call on 07401 856 681 or drop an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, it's time now for our first capsule of the day, so let's start by looking at the internet itself.
Okay, so it's certain that we all use the internet, and we see the internet as web pages that we look at on our individual computers, but what actually is the internet, and what is it made of?
Well, the internet is made up of a global system of interconnected computer networks. So it's kind of like a network of networks. And that's private, public, academic, governmental, and business. And they're all linked together by electronic, wireless, and optical technology.
Just like we might have wired or wireless or even fibre optic internet at home, with one router perhaps giving internet to several computers in the same house?
Exactly like that. So essentially, the internet is just lots and lots and lots of computers all linked together. And all these computers communicate with each other using something called the Standard Internet Protocol Suite.
Hold on, the Standard Internet Protocol Suite?
Yeah, now this is like a set of rules that govern how the internet works, and it's built up of four layers.
Okay, so what are each of these layers? And what do they do?
Well, they sort of divide the rules into different types of internet activity. So the bottom layer is the link layer, and that contains connectivity functions to allow different computers to connect with each other.
And then?
Well, then we have the internet layer. Now, this allows communication between different computers and networks. Now, this is really the nitty-gritty of the internet and contains lots of rules about how computers and networks are named, and that governs how they can communicate with each other.
So if that's the internet layer, and is pretty much the basis of the internet, what are the other two layers for?
Well, the other layers are the transport layer, which provides a general framework that allows data to be transferred around the networks. And then finally, there is the application layer, which essentially contains all the information that's needed by individual internet data and communication services to operate.
That all sounds pretty complicated to me.
Well, it is pretty complicated, but let's think of it a bit like an individual computer. So the link layer of the internet is a bit like your own internet connection, your modem or your router. It's about connecting to other computers. Then the next layer, the internet layer, is a bit like your Internet Explorer or Safari. It's about allowing you to communicate with other computers and see that content. Then your transport layer is a bit like your email or your Dropbox. It's about sending data or messages to other computers. And then finally, the application layer is a bit like individual internet sites or services like Google or Yahoo. Now, that's a massive simplification, but does that help?
Yeah, I think it does actually. But is there a difference between the internet and the World Wide Web?
Yes, there is. Now, the internet is a global data communication system. So it's a hardware and software infrastructure that provides connectivity between individual computers. Whereas the World Wide Web is one of the services that's communicated by the internet, and it's made up of interconnected documents and resources linked by hyperlinks and URLs.
Okay, but when was the internet actually invented?
Well, the origins of the internet reach right back to the 1960s. So initially, the internet started being developed as a way to link radar systems together. Now, the US was trying to outrun the USSR in the space race, and they were trying to build the most robust communications network that they could. The very first connections were between computers at the Pentagon, Cheyenne Mountain, and the Strategic Air Command headquarters. Now, gradually, technology improved, and more computers around the states joined together in these networks. And by the 1970s, there was the ARPANET in the US and Mark 1 in the UK, and basic interconnections between computer systems.
But this all sounds very official and was only serving government or academic institutions. So how did this translate into a more commercial and publicly accessible internet?
Well, in 1975, a network was established called Telenet, and this had free public dial-up access in cities across the US. And once this was established, similar networks were established in the UK, across Europe, in Canada, Hong Kong and Australia.
So there were lots of independent networks. And technology was improving all the time, but when did the internet become what we know as the internet today?
Well, eventually all these individual networks started to become interlinked as governments started to relax and individual ideas of ownership and privacy became more collaborative. But it wasn't until the 1990s that the World Wide Web was born, and that was invented by British scientist Tim Berners-Lee in 1989.
So since 1989, the internet, or World Wide Web, has really grown into a ubiquitous presence that we all use every single day, in some form or another at least, even if we're not aware of it. But who is in charge of the internet?
Well, the internet is a globally distributed network that's made up of many voluntarily interconnected networks. Now, to keep some standardisation in the structure of the internet so that all these networks can freely communicate, the infrastructure and namespaces of the internet are administered by the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN.
Hold on, you said something about there. What's a namespace?
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine, but if, again, you think of the internet as being just like your computer at home, and you know when you go to My Computer, you then see all your drives and folders and files all listed, and they're sort of all named like a filing system. So you might keep your short science scripts in a folder called short science scripts so that you know where to find them. Well, the internet is a bit like that. All the networks and information that they contain need naming properly so that other parts of the internet know what they are. and that's the role of ICANN to keep track of all this.
So is this about domain names and things like that?
Yes, and IP addresses and application port numbers. Everything to do with identifying information that's stored on the internet, on individual computers and on networks connected to the internet and their communication procedures.
Right, so who's in charge of the ICANN? Is there one man or woman at the top?
Well, there's an international board of directors who have expertise in technical, academic, governmental, business and non-commercial enterprises. But it is the government in the US that takes a leading role in approving changes to things like the domain name system, or DNS.
Well, now we know all about the basis of the internet and a little bit about how it's structured, let's think more about the World Wide Web and the content that we can find on it in our next capsule.
Okay, so we've established that what we use and experience as the internet is technically the World Wide Web. But everything that we see when we load a page on the internet is not actually everything that's there.
What do you mean?
Well, for every graphic or picture, every line of text and every link to other pages, there are actually lines and lines of code that govern how we see it.
So is this HTML?
For the most part, yes. Now, HTML, or hypertext markup language, is the predominant code used for building up web pages. Every piece of content, be it text, picture, link, whatever, is coded to tell the computer what colour to display it in, how big it should be, what font to use, the position of a picture or graphic. And all this information is contained within something called a tag.
So I assume, are there different types of tag?
Well, there are tags for virtually every parameter that governs what we see. So there are tags for headings, paragraphs, lists, links, quotes, and lots, lots more.
So if HTML is the main code of the internet, or of web pages, what other codes are there?
Well, there are other codes that work within HTML, for example, JavaScript. Now, that's a code that can be embedded within HTML and then will alter the way the HTML code will behave on the screen. Now, HTML can also be used alongside CSS, or cascading style sheets, which contain underlying information to sort of give some backup default style rules for the web page, like font type, size, and formatting.
Okay, so HTML is the predominant language of the internet and contains lots of codes that governs how web pages appear and function. But has this actually been around since the start of the internet?
Not since the start of the internet, but after Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web in 1989, he then invented HTML in about 1990. But it wasn't adopted right away, and even by late 1991, only a few basic HTML elements were being used.
So HTML had a bit of a rocky start, and then presumably grew into the extensive code that we have today?
Yeah, now HTML has been through many version changes, and to understand all the HTML that is used in contemporary coding, you would need to read and memorise a very big book indeed. And there has been some argy-bargy about what HTML should actually be used for.
How do you mean?
Well, there are two aspects to what we see on a web page. There's the content, so what is actually written, and then there is the way that it appears or how it looks.
And HTML governs both of those?
Well, it has done in various incarnations of HTML over the years. But using HTML to emphasise the appearance of the web is often termed semantic HTML. But since CSS can be used to govern appearance, there's been a drive to keep HTML for the expression of content alone, with neutral presentation tags, allowing CSS to then dictate the appearance of the content.
But why is it important to keep the content and appearance code separate?
Well, there are lots of automated web bots that read all the content on the internet and find meaning and connections between content. An example of this is a search engine spider. Now, we all know that if we type something into Google, it will find us tens of thousands of web pages related to the term that we typed. Now, search engines like Google control web pages more effectively if the content code is separate from the appearance code.
Okay, so that's cleared that up a bit, but what's actually the latest version of HTML?
Well, coming out later this year and already in use by many web designers is the latest incarnation, HTML5. Now, in HTML5, it's actually illegal to include semantic information in the HTML code. This has to be provided by other means like CSS.
Okay, are there any other changes in the new version of HTML?
Well, HTML5 has become a lot more multimedia friendly. So there are new tags and code that make it really simple to link to or display graphics, video and audio within a web page.
So was this tricky before? I mean, there are lots of websites that have had those elements already.
Well, the code for embedding these elements has been really bulky, unstable and quite difficult to use. So at the moment, some websites code these elements in HTML, but many more use other coding to include these elements, such as Adobe Flash.
So what are the benefits of using something like Flash?
Well, it's very stable and much easier to control the appearance and function of multimedia elements using something like Flash.
So why don't we just keep using Flash and not worry about HTML for media, multimedia objects?
Well, the issue with something like Flash is that it's proprietary. It's owned by Adobe, whereas HTML is not owned by anybody. It's in the public domain.
So is this why there are issues with Apple products and Flash?
Supposedly. It's very difficult to unpick the actual arguments between Apple and Adobe regarding Flash. But in essence, Apple says that it won't support using Flash, for example, on the iPhone, because of the proprietary nature of Flash. And because they knew that HTML5 was in the pipeline, and HTML5 has the potential to make Flash extinct.
So HTML5 is that good at handling the multimedia elements that web developers won't need to use third-party codes to include these things anymore?
Well, that's the general idea, but I guess we're probably going to have to wait to see how well all that works out. So right now, we're going to move on to consider the social impact of the internet, and specifically the social codes that have developed around the internet.
Okay, so there's no denying that the revolution of the internet has completely altered the world in which we live, and no doubt in ways that we even struggle to truly understand now. So it's one thing to consider the internet code in a sort of informational manner, but I'm particularly interested in looking at internet code in a sociological manner.
So is this actually a scientific field then?
I suppose it's just more a fresh application of sociological theory and methods to the internet as a source of both information but also of communication. So some sociologists are analysing the implications for social interactions that have developed in regards to social networks like Facebook and Twitter, and also the virtual communities that have developed via the internet. I suppose you can think about it as analysing internet etiquette.
So how are sociologists looking at this then?
Well, different methods are specifically appropriate to trying to find out different information, obviously. But take, for instance, online communities can be studied statistically through network analysis, or more qualitatively, they might do it, say, by adaptation of ethnography, termed virtual ethnography. Large social change as well can also be studied statistically through, you know, just general demographics.
So is this idea of the internet etiquette an official thing?
Obviously, on a general level, a large aspect of this is down to common sense. But there are some examples, such as netiquette, which is short for network etiquette, or sort of internet etiquette, really. And this is a set of social conventions that facilitate interaction over networks. So it's meant for use in all areas of electronic means, including sort of email, chatting on the internet, blogging, forums, message boards, and so on. However, like most internet phenomena, the concept and its application remain in a sort of state of flux, and obviously varies from community to community. Netiquette's origins actually predate the start of the World Wide Web, and actually the term itself has been used since probably early 1980s.
Okay, so can you give us any examples of these netiquette rules then?
Well, admit some of them seem slightly silly, such as not writing in capitals, because this seems like shouting, but I suppose we actually do stick to that sort of rule. But beyond that, there's sort of amongst the top 10 netiquette points are some sensible ones, like, you know, keeping your personal information private, and as well as obeying copyright laws and things like that.
Are people only interested in the internet etiquette of individuals rather than groups?
I think there's sort of a lot of the internet etiquette that we do abide by personally, whether doing so consciously or not, and that's certainly of critical interest. But actually, people are interested in looking at internet etiquette on a variety of levels. So, for instance, if you think about how the internet is used as a political tool, I think you start to get a sense of just how fundamental the internet has become as part of our sort of social infrastructure. So, you know, if you think about it at a governmental level, the internet actually can be very influential and potentially quite sort of scary, really. Some countries, such as Cuba, North Korea, they use filtering software to censor what people in their country can actually access on the internet. And there are a number of cases where they actually use software to locate and arrest sort of, well, various individuals that they perceive as a threat. Being obviously deceitful in that kind of way is not really considered a positive characteristic that we employ on personal or perhaps sort of on those sort of social interaction levels. Yet the anonymity of the internet, I certainly think, allows so much more for these characteristics to play out. And as well, that goes for on a personal level. There's another way which I think this idea of group social etiquette on the internet is quite interesting, is this idea of cyber slacking. So this term has actually been coined to refer to people surfing the internet, say at work, for personal reasons. And this actually is a surprisingly big problem for businesses. It's thought that on average, people spend just under about 57 minutes per working day sort of cyber slacking. And it's estimated that it actually costs employers $1 billion a year in computer resources.
Okay, so what about on sort of a smaller, more personal scale?
Well, I think obviously the sociological impact of the internet underwent its major shift when the internet became so domesticated. I mean, it's a prominent feature of most home sort of technological suites now. A report published about the internet use, this was in the States, showed that more than 50% of parents of children between sort of the ages of 11 and 15 say they allow their kids to go online whenever they feel like it, and I'm sure the same would be true in the UK. This number actually increases to as high as 75% of teenagers older than about 16. Some studies have actually shown there kind of a small but reliable declines in social as well as psychological well-being. For instance, people of the above study, which was actually conducted in Pittsburgh, reported spending less and less time with their families. Of course, you must be careful to generalise the conclusions of studies like this to wider groups of people.
It does sound a little bit severe, surely.
Yeah, I'm sure it is, really. But there is research that indicates that perhaps the circumstances aren't as bad as this. But that the ease of electronic communication may lead to, say, just weaker social ties because people have less reason sort of maybe to leave their homes. Maybe people do their shopping on the internet and everything now and actually interact face-to-face with people. So I think this point is important because psychologists in many different areas of research have described and have improved, really, that face-to-face and even just telephone connections are of a higher sort of social quality when viewed anyway in their kind of contribution to people's well-being.
Okay, so many of us continually use the internet on a day-to-day basis and we don't feel that we're experiencing any of those downsides though.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I agree. And there's research that looks at all of this actually in a completely different way. Researchers show that people sooner or later can typically convert their cyber contacts into more traditional face-to-face friendships. So the internet is more used as a first or primary platform. And I think it's sort of now acceptable etiquette for people to use the internet to actually sort of achieve real-life goals, be them social or otherwise. So rather than technology changing people's sort of social and psychological reality, in other words, people change the use of their psychology to actually facilitate the creation of sort of new desired social realities and interactions.
So are there different interactive tactics for different aspects of the internet?
Certainly. I mean, if you take something like Twitter, for instance, this is actually quite strange because it requires different social strategies compared to these normal interactions that I was talking about. If you think about it, really, this social media aspect, they effectively collapse multiple audiences into a single context, making it difficult for people to use the same techniques online that they do to handle this sort of multiplicity in face-to-face conversation. So if you think of Twitter, it's kind of, you have to use the idea of an imagined audience. You're not talking to a specific person or even a few people. You have to, whatever you write and whatever you tweet has to apply to a wide audience, really. And that rarely happens to us in real life, as we're often obviously aware of speaking to one or two people and who they actually are.
So do you think that these virtual social interactions influence the very manner in which we use the internet?
Yeah, I'd say they completely influence it. If you just think about the number of times now that you actually use your social networks to find out information, say by asking your friends for recommendations of websites or music or places to go, rather than obviously the sort of typical search engines. And this has actually become such an important aspect of internet use that even Google is trying to exploit the social code, if you like, of the internet. So Google obviously depends on being the primary search point for the internet. But as many people are spending more and more time as part of these closed social networks, such as Facebook, where much of the information is actually closed off to the search engines, so Google really is at risk of losing out of being that primary sort of search engine. And it was only in August of last year, for the first time, that it was kind of a survey revealed that people spent more time on Facebook than they did on Google-related sites. So Google are actually now, I think maybe December last year, announced that they're trying to make this, sort of the incorporation of this social component to their sites, a greater priority amongst their core products.
Well, it's a very interesting look at the social aspects and codes that govern the internet. Well, it's time now for our weekly quiz. Okay, so today I am going to be quizzing Katie on her knowledge of all sorts of things internet related. So first up, what colour is the new HTML5 logo? So it says HTML at the top, and then it's got the number 5 in a kind of shield shape. And what colour is that shield? Is it A, red, B, green, or C, orange?
Admittedly, I have no idea. If it's a shield, I'm going to go against orange. For some reason, that doesn't seem to fit in my head. Maybe I'll plug for red.
It was actually orange. Oh. It does look a bit bizarre. I mean, I don't know why anyone would think it was attractive and choose to use it as a logo, but they have. So there we go. So the HTML5 logo has an orange shield. Okay, so next question. We know that Web 2.0 is about user interaction and user-generated content, but what is the point of Web 3.0? Is it A, about computer-generated content, B, about better user-generated content, or C, about content that interacts and uses non-traditional viewing platforms like touchscreens and holographic technology?
Again, I don't know at all, but I'm going to say, in a bit of a guess, that things are progressing towards touchscreens, what with our phones and everything, so I think, yeah, I might go with C.
Okay, it sort of might be, but it's actually a bit more to do with computer-generated content, and this is a bit of the point about semantic HTML and separating out the code that determines what things look like from the content. Because if all the content is coded in just one way, then computers can actually make sense of internet content. They can go around and find information from different pages and then present that information to us. And that's what Web 3.0 is about. It's about letting computers actually go out, look for the right content, put it together, and then bring it back to us, as opposed to us doing that ourselves using something like Google.
Seems that maybe I need to go back and listen to this radio show again myself to get to grips with all these aspects.
It seems like a bit of a freaky thing, though, using computers to actually generate stuff. It's a bit like, you know, giving over all of our control to them and not actually, you know, using our own brains to think about whether something's right or not. And just going, well, the computer says so.
I do always like the thought of a human being behind thoughts and the things that I see. So,
yeah, I think that's a bit scary, personally. Okay, well, that's about all we've got time for today. Now, don't forget to get in touch with your thoughts about inheritance for next week's show. Now, you can call in your message to 07-401-856-681 or email us, studio@shortscience.co.uk. And don't forget to check out our website, shortscience.co.uk, for details of every show, including what's coming up next week. And you can find out how to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or listen online to any episode you should so choose. Well, thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. My name is Elizabeth Hawke, and I was your presenter and producer today. My co-presenter was Katie Draper. The theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design. Thank you very much for listening, and join us again next week for another episode of Short Science.
Radiofonica.com.
La migliore musica italiana in esclusiva.
Gli artisti emergenti più interessanti.
I live più adrenalinici.
La black music di Piotta.
Il music book di Dario Salvatori.
La musica al femminile di Note Rosa.
Videogames, animazione, cultura moderna.
Tutto questo e molto altro è Ubix, il miglior free press di musica e cultura in circolazione. Da gennaio Ubix arriva in Umbria. Cercalo ogni mese sul web e nelle migliori location della regione.
www.ubixweb.com.
Ubix.
Free press, free spirit, free music.
The border zone of the night. Love the way the light is filtering through. I hold by the half-word sunlight. Lie on the bed you hate to love. Let your body roll right onto my side. Time has come to recognize that it's alright, so alright. Yeah,
'cause it's alright for me, and it's alright, so
ma se stringo un po' dai tuoi occhi, escono lacrime, ti insegno a piangere, malgrado tu sai far ridere forte di me. Se faccio il pugile, quando in realtà basterebbe ballassi con te per annegarci di felicità. Ma è che se guardo tutto le vertigini, mandi in alto tesoro se mi guardi così. E quassù mi manca l'aria, e salirei
Radio Funica.